You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 205 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled The Human Being as Body and Soul in Relation to the Cosmos, 13 lectures translated by William Forward. This is Lecture 8, given in Dornach on the 8th of July, 1921. In preparation for our next two sessions, we shall devote our attention to aspects of the human being that relate to our nature as thinking beings. It is just this aspect of our nature that science misunderstands or characterizes quite wrongly. People think that thoughts, as we experience them, arise in us, as if we were in a way the bearers of these thoughts. It comes as no surprise that people hold this view, since our true nature is only accessible to a more subtle observation. Our true nature is withheld from a crude approach to observing it. If we see ourselves as thinking beings, it is because, while we are awake, between waking up and falling asleep, we can see that our other experiences are accompanied by thoughts, by the content of our thoughts. These experiences in thought seem to us to arise within us somehow, and then, somehow, to cease in the period spent between sleeping and waking, during sleep, that is. It is because we take the view that our experience of thinking only takes place while we are awake, and that it disappears into the unknown during sleep, about which we do not take the trouble to find out, we cannot come to an understanding of ourselves as thinking beings. If we adopt a more subtle approach, even one that does not go as far as the region I have described in my book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, we will see that our thinking life is nothing like as simple as we tend to imagine. We only have to begin with a comparison of our basic everyday way of thinking between waking and sleeping, we all know it, with the admittedly problematic state we are in when dreaming. When we talk about dreaming, most people are generally satisfied with a rough characterization of the dreaming state. A comparison of our dreaming state with wide awake thinking shows that dreams contain what we might call random associations, images appearing in a sequence one after the other without the connection appearing that one would see in the world around us. Alternatively, one might relate what is going on in a dream to the outer world, and notice how it stands out in contrast, and seen as a whole will simply not fit in with the processes of the world outside. It is true these are observations that one can make, which lead to fine results. What goes unnoticed, however, is that when we cease to concentrate for a moment and give our thoughts free rein, something not unlike our dreaming state blends with our waking consciousness, which otherwise follows the outer course of events. In the time between waking up and going to sleep, whilst we make every effort to adapt to the outer events in which we are involved, a vague dreaming also takes place. It is as if there were two streams present in us, the upper one which we can control as we wish, and the lower one which takes its course like dreams themselves, with images following each other at random. One does have to be a little attentive to one's inner life to observe what I am describing, but it is always there. You will invariably notice that there is an undercurrent present. Thoughts go swirling about, just as full of images as they do in dreams, all kinds of things, one after another. A variety of reminiscences appear which, just as in a dream, attract other thoughts, with perhaps only similar-sounding words to link them. People who are content to let their thoughts have free rein, or who are unwilling to make the effort to link them with what is going on around them, may notice that there is an inner urge to give way to such daydreaming. These daydreams only differ from normal dreams in that the images are paler and more like thoughts. With regard to how these images relate to each other, however, there is little difference between daydreaming and so-called real dreams. People range in their relationship to daydreams from those who have no idea that such daydreams are present, as an undercurrent in their consciousness, and who let their thoughts be guided entirely by outer events, to those who completely abandon themselves to their daydreams and allow their thoughts to mingle and become entangled with them. Between the extremes of such dreamy characters and those who are quite dry and will accept nothing but what corresponds exactly to a given sequence of facts, there are all kinds of different tendencies. We should add that a substantial part of what nourishes art and poetry, etc., comes from this undercurrent of daydreaming during the course of the day. That is one aspect of what we are considering, and it should definitely be taken into account. It would then become clear to us that there is a constant ebb and flow of dreams within us, which we can only control by means of dealing with the outer world. It would also become clear that it is essentially our will that takes its lead from our surroundings and which brings system, coherence, and logic into our otherwise anarchic inner thought processes. It is our will that brings logic into our thinking. That is, however, only one side of the issue. The other side is the following. We need only to have made an initial acquaintance with the regions I described in my book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, to become aware of how, when we awake in the morning, we bring something with us from the condition we were in between falling asleep and waking up. We have only to add a little consciousness to what we perceive at that moment to realize very clearly that at the moment of awakening we are waking up out of a sea of thoughts, as it were. We are by no means waking up out of something indistinct or darkness, but actually out of a sea of thoughts. Thoughts that leave the impression that they were very clear indeed whilst we were asleep, but which can no longer be grasped or carried over into waking consciousness. Taking this further, we will begin to notice that these thoughts, brought with us, as it were, out of sleep, are very similar to new ideas or solutions that we have to something that we have to deal with in the outer world. Indeed, that they are very similar to moral intuitions, as I have described them in my title, Philosophy of Spiritual Activity. While we may always have the feeling that the kind of weaving thoughts that accompany our consciousness as a kind of undercurrent confront us with ourselves as bubbling and simmering daydreams, we cannot say that of what we mentioned earlier. On the contrary, we have to say to ourselves, when we return to our bodies, taking hold of them for our daily tasks, we are not capable of retaining what we experienced in our thought life between falling asleep and waking up. Once we have become fully aware of these two aspects of human life, we will no longer regard thoughts as the products of our physical organism. The state we emerge from at the moment of waking up cannot be seen as just some product of our physical organism, but rather as something that we have experienced between falling asleep and waking up when our astral body and I, capital, were separated from our physical body. Where are we then? This is a question we have to ask ourselves. Our I and our astral body are outside our etheric and physical bodies. If we are prepared to look at life with an open mind, a simple consideration we must inevitably come to will reveal the following. When we are outside ourselves in this way, we are in fact in the midst of all that appears to us when we direct our senses to the outer world to the veil of the senses, to all that our senses can reveal to us. At the same time, however, our ordinary daytime consciousness is extinguished. We can feel why our consciousness is extinguished when we wake out of this state in the morning. The feeling we have in our body on awakening is that it is too weak to keep a grip on what we experience between falling asleep and waking up. Our eye and our astral body cannot retain their experiences as they dip back into our physical and etheric bodies. The moment they take part in the experiences offered by our physical and etheric bodies, they can no longer retain what they experienced between falling asleep and waking up. It is only when we have new ideas relating to the world around us, or moral intuitions, that we experience something like what would appear to us directly if we were conscious of our surroundings during the time between falling asleep and waking up. Taking this into consideration, we have a very clear contrast between our inner and outer worlds. In a way, this sheds light on the expression we often use, namely that the outer world, as it appears to us, between sleeping and waking, is a kind of illusion or maya. In fact, we only truly inhabit the world which reveals itself to us in this way when we are asleep. Then we submerge ourselves in the world which otherwise only reveals itself to us through our senses. We might then say that the world that reveals itself through our senses has hidden depths within which lie contained its primal causes, its being. In our normal consciousness, we are too weak to perceive these causes and beings directly. Unprejudiced observation will, however, take us quite far into those regions I've described in my book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds. What I might represent in a diagram as follows will be clear to an open-minded observer. To represent what goes on in our everyday life of thought, I would include everything we inwardly experience in our thoughts between waking up and going to sleep in relation to outer perceptions, or to our pains and pleasures. I would represent our experiences in ordinary consciousness like this. There's a drawing on page 114. Beneath it, there would be what I first described, which is like a daydream, living and weaving without being subject to the laws of logic. Opposite this, in the outer world, we pass into between falling asleep and waking up, we find ourselves once more in a world of thoughts which we can reach in the form of reminiscences on awakening, a world of thoughts which are not within us, but which receive us into themselves. In this way, using our ordinary thinking, we have distinguished two separate worlds of thought, an inner one and an outer one, a world of thoughts which is filled by the cosmos once we have fallen asleep. We could call this the cosmic world of thought. The previous one, referred to, is some other world of thought, which we will examine more closely during the coming days. So within our ordinary world of thought, we are placed within a general world of thought, which is, as it were, divided by a boundary, the one part being inside us, the other outside. The one that is inside us appears to us very clearly as a kind of dream. In the depths of our soul, there lives a chaotic web of thoughts, which we could say is not imbued with logic. The outer world of thought, however, can't be perceived in ordinary consciousness. The only way we can see and experience the nature of this outer world of thought directly is by means of genuine spiritual second sight, which can penetrate more deeply into the regions I described in my book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds. We then discover that the world of thought we dive into between falling asleep and waking up is one which is not only just as logical as our everyday world of thought, but also contains a much higher logic. To avoid any misunderstanding, I shall call this a super-logical world of thought. One could say that It lies just as far above our ordinary logic as the nebulous world of our daydreams lies below it. As I indicated earlier, this can only be explored with spiritual second sight. There is another way to test the results of spiritual research on this point. It will be obvious to you that there are certain areas of our organism that we do not have access to with our ordinary consciousness. I have referred to them frequently in recent lectures. I pointed out that the faculty of memory that we have in our ordinary consciousness involves having a kind of skin covering our internal organs. We cannot directly perceive the nature of our internal organs, such as lungs, liver, and so on. I also added that the kind of mysticism which fantasizes about what lies within us and is expressed in the words of St. Teresa or Mechthild of Magdeburg with all kinds of beautiful poetic images, their beauty is undeniable, is nevertheless a false and nebulous one, consisting of nothing more than organic secretions. If we pursue real spiritual science rather than this nebulous mysticism, we shall penetrate through what lies within the human being to genuine knowledge of the organs. We will then have the faculties to grasp the spiritual significance of our lungs, liver, kidneys, and so on. Having spiritually penetrated through the fine skin of memory, and attained a spiritual grasp of our inner nature. This cannot be achieved with our ordinary everyday consciousness. We can only observe the organs outwardly by means of anatomy, which will show us how they behave when they are considered only as belonging to the ordinary physical and mineral world. Only fully developed spiritual powers of vision will be able to observe them from within, seeing the forces with which they are imbued, what is at work in them. So there is something within us that we cannot reach with our ordinary consciousness. Why not? Because it does not belong to us alone. What we are able to observe with our everyday consciousness belongs to us alone. What is coursing through our organs down there does not belong to us alone, but to our cosmic human nature, and thus both to us and to the cosmos at the same time. This can perhaps be explained most clearly as follows. Looking at ourselves schematically, we can take any given organ, like our lungs or liver, and see that there are forces at work within it. These forces are not simply our own internal forces, but belong to the entire cosmos. Moreover, when the whole outer physical world that we can observe with our senses will one day have disappeared as the earth reaches its natural end, these forces within our internal organs will continue to work on. We could say that everything that our eyes can see, that our ears can hear, the whole outer world, will pass away in time with the earth. On the other hand, what we bear within us beneath our skin contains something that will outlive the earth. These are the centers, the forces that will continue to work beyond the earth's existence. Our position as human beings in the world is not just to be a vessel for our organs, but also to be a vessel within which the whole cosmos can take shape. Thus, within what is inaccessible to our everyday consciousness, we encompass something that belongs not just to us, but to the entire cosmos. The question is it composed of the chaotic processes that take place in our daydreams, our waking dreams? We have only to consider these chaotic processes at work in our waking dreams to conclude. The whole structure of what we can observe as an underground current in our consciousness is certainly not the basis of our entire organism, including each individual organ. It would be a sight to behold if the chaos rumbling through our subconscious life were to be the architect of our organs, let alone our entire organism. You would be astonished by the caricatures that would result if we were the products of what goes pulsing through our subconscious life. No, we are made up of the same external powers of thought which shape the outer world, inclining its outer surface toward our senses. That is, those at work in the world which we experience between falling asleep and waking up, and which we are unable to reach with our ordinary consciousness. So if I wanted to represent what we are in the form of a complete picture, I would have to do it a little like this. See diagram on page 117. That is the world of thoughts surrounding us. This enveloping world of thought shapes our human organism, and this in turn, floating above it, as it were, creates the upper world of thoughts, which leans toward the external maya, which we perceive with our senses between our thoughts and the surrounding world. Now, try to become fully aware of how small that part of us is, which constitutes our consciousness, and how large that part of us is which is formed by the same outer world into which we plunge between falling asleep and waking up. This can also be seen from a different perspective by an open-minded observer. In our ordinary consciousness, we are only fully aware of our thoughts. Our feelings swim along like dreams, as it were, beneath them. Feelings rise up and ebb away. We are unable to capture them with the same clarity as our thoughts and concepts. What we experience between falling asleep and waking up closely resembles our experience of will at work during the day. What, after all, do we know about what is taking place when our will is at work in the movement of our hand or an arm? This is easy enough to understand conceptually. We are initially aware, I wanted to move my arm. That is an idea. Then we recall how we look once we have moved an arm. Another idea. Everything we are aware of in our ordinary consciousness is a web of ideas. Beneath this web, there is a flow of feelings. But the will within us is just as unconscious during our waking state as we ourselves are between falling asleep and waking up. What is it exactly that sleeps within us? What the cosmos around us has built into us, and is now asleep, is just as asleep as the plants and minerals are from our waking perspective. In effect, we cannot penetrate into them from outside. We cannot see through into the cosmic nature that we have in common. We live and weave in this cosmos between falling asleep and waking up. The degree to which we are able to penetrate through the surface of the outer world of the senses corresponds to our ability to consciously inhabit our own organization. The extent to which we are able to cease having mere memories or reminiscences of the events we have experienced in daily life corresponds to our ability to consciously experience the forces at work in building up our lungs, liver, stomach, and so on. To the same extent that we learn to see through the phenomena of the outer world, we can learn to experience consciously our own piece of the cosmos, the one we live in, that is enclosed within our skin, without us being aware of it in ordinary consciousness. What do we bring with us out of this cosmos on awakening? An open-minded observer will see at once that what we bring with us is very definitely will. Our waking thoughts essentially only differ from what flows through our dreamy subconscious life, in that they are imbued with will. It is our willpower that introduces logic. And this logic is not actually a system of thought, but reflects the way our will orders us and controls our thought images in such a way that they correspond to the outer ways of the world. When we wake up from a dream, we are particularly aware of the swirling jumble of chaotic and illogical pictures that live within us, and we can then notice how our will takes hold of it and organizes it in a logical way. What we carry with us into the day, however, is not the cosmic logic referred to earlier as superlogic, but the logic of our own will. How is it possible, then, for our will to bring this logic to bear within us? The underlying cause is an exceptionally important secret of human nature. It is this: when we are submerged in the cosmic state of being, which does not exist as far as our ordinary consciousness is concerned, we are submerged within the entirety of our organization. And there we can sense within our will that is spread out within it the cosmic logic of our organs. It is extremely important to realize that when we wake up in the morning, rejoining our bodily nature, we are forced by this bodily nature to give shape to our will in a particular way. If our body had not itself taken on a certain shape, our will would swirl around in all directions like jellyfish at the moment of awakening. The only thing that prevents this is our present human form. Our will dives down and assumes this form in all its elements. That is what gives it its logical structure. It is our own body that makes it possible for our will to give logical coherence to the thoughts which would otherwise swirl around chaotically. During the night, when we are asleep, we are contained within the superlogic of the cosmos. We are, however, unable to retain it. So when our will dives back down into our physical body, it takes on its form. Just as when you pour water into a vessel and the water takes the shape of the vessel, our will takes the shape of our physical body. Not only does it take the overall form of our body, but it flows into its every detail right down to the tiniest capillaries. The vessel cannot move, and so the water takes on the resting form of the vessel it is poured into, touching only its outer walls. In our case, however, our will immerses itself completely in every nook and cranny of our body, and from there exercises its control on the otherwise chaotic sequence of images. What we are aware of as a kind of subconscious undercurrent is, in a sense, released from the body. It really is released from our body. Whilst it does remain connected, it is constantly trying to release itself from the form of our body. On the other hand, what we carry with us into the cosmos at the moment of falling asleep, and which bears our human form, merges with the cosmos, but still remains subject to the laws of this form. Now, despite the complexity of the way our head is organized, we are only able to form images with it. In terms of physiology, it is only a matter of prejudice that leads us to believe that our heads enable us to form judgments and come to conclusions. It is, in fact, only thoughts that are enabled by our heads. If we only had heads and the rest of our bodies were not involved in the process of thinking, we would all be daydreamers. All that our heads are capable of is remaining awake while we dream. So when we return to our bodies via our head in the morning, our head lets us become aware of our dreams. It is only when we penetrate more fully into our body, when our will takes on the form both of our head and the rest of our organization, that our will is once more able to restore logic to the otherwise chaotically swirling, image-forming forces within us. This brings us to something I raised in the earlier lectures. We have to be clear about the fact that our thoughts are facilitated by our heads, and that, strange and paradoxical as it may sound, in reality our judgments and our conclusions are formed by our arms and legs. That is how judgments and conclusions are arrived at. When we have a thought, it is only an image, mirrored back to us in our head. Our whole being, on the other hand, is involved in arriving at judgments and conclusions. This does not mean that if a person is deformed, he is also unable or disqualified from forming a judgment or of coming to a conclusion. What matters is a person's predisposition, irrespective of the loss of one limb or another. We will have to learn that what we are in soul and spirit must be seen in the context of our wholeness. This will involve seeing that logic is brought into our life of thought from the very regions that we are unable to reach with our ordinary consciousness, and which are occupied by our feeling and willing natures. Our judgments and our conclusions take place within the sleeping regions of our soul, from which sound our feelings and our will impulses. Of these, the mathematical region is the most peculiar. The mathematical region is not accessible to us merely in our resting state, but also involves us as we walk about. Somehow or other, we are always in movement when dealing with mathematical figures. When we look at someone walking about from outside, we see the person in spatial terms. When we experience mathematics inwardly, we experience cosmic mathematics at work within us, and at the same time building us up. The directions of space outside us also build us up, and we experience them within us. In the process of experiencing them, we convert them into abstractions, take the images which are reflected in our brains, and weave them together with what the world reveals to us externally in space. It will be necessary for us to become aware today that what we place into the world by means of doing mathematics is of the same cosmic nature as the laws that apply to ourselves. The nonsense promulgated by Kantianism portrays space as a subjective form. It is not a subjective form, but something that we experience in all reality in the very region where we experience our will nature. That is where it radiates up from. As it radiates up, it becomes a world which we can then imbue with what is presented to us from outside. Today's world is a long way from being able to study the way in which we are inwardly interwoven with the cosmos. Now we stand in relation to the cosmos. This is something that I presented with particular clarity in my title Philosophy of Spiritual Activity, which contains notable passages where I show how, in ordinary consciousness, we are connected with the entire cosmos, and that it is from the seedbed of the entire cosmos that the individual person blossoms, whom we are then able to apprehend with our normal consciousness. It is this passage in my title, Philosophy of Spiritual Activity, that has been least understood. Most people did not know what it was about. It is perhaps not surprising that in an age in which abstraction has flourished to the point of admiring Einstein's ideas, an age in which this admittedly extraordinarily clever but nevertheless extreme abstraction is presented to the world as something special, there is no understanding for what is aiming to lead us into true reality. One has continually to emphasize that it is not sufficient for something to be logical. Einstein's ideas are certainly logical, but they do not correspond to reality. No form of relativism as such corresponds to reality. The kind of thinking that does correspond to reality involves not letting go of reality while in the process of thinking. People today, for example, are quite happy to read or to hear in a lecture by Einstein, quote, "How would it be if a clock flew out into the cosmos at the speed of light?" Close quote. People are quite happy to listen to this kind of thing. For someone whose thinking and soul life are in touch with reality, this is the equivalent of saying, quote, "How would it be for a person if I cut off his head and then his left hand or his right arm?" And so on. Close quote. This person would then no longer be a human being. Similarly, what we are entitled to think of as a clock ceases to be a clock once we start talking about it flying through the cosmos at the speed of light. It is not possible to think of it that way. We have to stick to reality if we want to develop valid thoughts. Something can be logical and even immensely clever without corresponding in any way to reality. Thinking that is rooted in reality is what we need in our time. Abstract thinking will in the end take us to the point where we are no longer able to see reality amidst all the abstractions. People admire abstractions today when they are presented in this way. Proving these abstractions logically is simply not relevant. What matters is that we learn to embed ourselves in reality to such an extent that we are no longer able to say anything other than what is founded in reality. The ideas about our human nature that I have shared with you today are a kind of guide to a thinking that is in touch with reality. You will often encounter mockery from those who have been trained in our abstract thinking. Western civilization has been schooled in purely abstract thinking for the last 300 to 400 years. But we are now living in an age where we will have to turn this around and find our way back to reality. People have become materialists, not because they have lost their connection with logic, but because they have lost their connection with reality. Materialism is logical. Spiritualism is logical. Monadism is logical, as is dualism, so long as they are not founded on errors of thought. The fact, however, that something is logical does not mean it corresponds to reality. Reality can only be found when we ourselves bring our thinking steadily more into the region to which I was referring. When I said, quote, when we are engaged in pure thinking, we have caught hold of a tassel of the cosmic process, close quote. That can be found in any epistemological writings and is the basis for an understanding of the world that we still have to acquire. The moment we are still thinking, despite not having any sense impressions, is also a moment when we are thinking and willing together. There is no distinction between willing and thinking. Thinking is then an act of will, and willing is then thought. When our thinking has become completely free of sense impressions is when we have caught hold of a tassel of the cosmic process. That is what we have to strive to achieve above all else, a concept of this pure thinking. We shall speak more about this tomorrow, the end of Lecture 8.